history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, boy, do we add to our understanding. We're educated, we're entertained, and often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This weekend marks Independence Day and the 244th anniversary of the moment when John Hancock signed that document that would change the course of history. A month later, 55 others added their signatures in support of the Declaration of Independence. With a firm reliance on divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor, they said. In short, they risked everything they had for an experiment in support of what they called self-evident truths, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That sentiment, expressed 244 years ago, remains the central ideal of America. It was not applied perfectly then, and recent events remind us it isn't perfect now either. And 75 years ago, there were some pretty clear inconsistencies, but when held up to the light against the despotic machine of Nazi Germany and the merciless advance of Imperial Japan, the ideals of America were worth fighting for, even when it came to people who had not received the fully matured promise of the Declaration's equality. Today we're going to hear the memories of three World War II veterans, one Caucasian, one African American, and one Japanese American. We're going to hear what they were facing 75 years ago in July of 1945. And by the end of this hour, their perspectives may have had an impact on your perspective, both about World War II and with regard to the state of our Union today. First, let's listen to Patch Curtis, who at this time 75 years ago was still trying to recover from injuries he'd suffered 4 months earlier with the 1st Cavalry Division in the push to liberate Antipolo on the Philippine island of Luzon.
The first thing that happened, an A-20A attack plane with a smoke started, and they just laid a smoke screen 10 miles across the face of that mountain. They had 4.2 chemical mortars set up in intervals all down through that 10-mile section, firing red smoke shells. And as these red shells would go up, they were spaced apart. Each unit was supposed to stay in that line that was delineated by these smoke lines. So when they made the blackout, these red lines started up and we were given the order to go. So we went ahead. Now, our particular assignment that day was to take a artillery observation unit from a 155-millimeter howitzer battery and place them on their optimum observation point. We were supposed to escort them up and get them put down on the place where they were supposed to direct the fire from their battery. I had been on patrol in that day before and was most familiar with the area that they wanted to go traverse, so I was appointed point. So we started out at 8 o'clock up through the smoke screen after the massive artillery barrage went off ahead of us, and as we went up, the ground was filled with craters 12 to 18 inches deep. Ground looked like it had just been plowed with these shells, but we went on up, and when I say up, it was the base of a mountain, and as you went further up, it got steeper and steeper and steeper. Sure. We were pretty successful and didn't receive too much resistance, and only a couple of firefights on the way up. Till about 11 o'clock, we got up down a particular area. We ran into some resistance. The unit commander decided the best way to subdue the Japanese was we had a bazooka section that would fire bazooka shells, a 60-millimeter mortar section, and so they fired up all the bazooka shells. The Japs still continued to fire back at us. All of the mortar shells got used up trying to knock them out, so there weren't any more mortar shells available. So finally, platoon sergeant said to me, Curtis, take your squad down and see if you can knock them out with grenades. We were up on the lee side of a hill where they couldn't get to us, so I went down the backside and around, and it was kind of an open swale down and a hill up on the backside over here, and I went around. I made sure all of them had four grenades and full belt of ammo and so on. Well, I started out with them down and went around and headed around here, and I said, let's pick up the pace. We don't want to be standing around too slow and make a good target. And so we started kind of moving a little faster, and we were firing as we were advancing. And one of my guys stumbled and went down, and as he went down, he almost hit me. He was pulling off shots as he fell down, and I turned and said, you almost hit me. Get up. And he was down on his hands and knees like this. I kicked him in the behind, and he greatest started to get up and so on. And by then, the first bullet hit me over on the left shoulder here, and I figured, well, we were stopped. We were in wide open space, and we're not moving anymore. We're dead meat. So I started to turn to say, let's get out of here. And that's when the bullet hit me in the chest here.
What did that feel like?
It knocked the breath out of me, and I went down on my back. It spun me around. I couldn't get my breath. A fleeting thought went through, well, I guess this is it. But for some reason, I got my breath a little bit. Somehow I got initial shock. I guess my heart stopped or something, too. I don't know. But anyway, a guy grabbed me by one leg and pulled me back around this point of this little hill and so on. I don't know how they got me back up on the top of the hill in the back. I was unconscious by then. I woke up. I remember the aid man was working on me, and they were giving me some morphine. And I remember when I'd breathe, it was going like that, and I had tried to get my hand over here to close it up.
So you could tell that your lung was punctured?
Well, I didn't know. It just hurt, and I couldn't get my heart to get my breath. I was real short of breath, and I was coughing a little bit, and I was in and out after that. But when one incident, I woke up, and my fellow squad leader, a fellow by the name, my last name was Carmona, he had me in his lap, and the aid man had told him to keep my shoulder up so I wouldn't drown in my own blood. So he was kind of holding me up in his lap. And I heard, for Christ's sake, Carmona, take your carbine and shoot me. I can't stand this pain. He says, well, I'll get the aid man to give you some more morphine. And the aid man, Andy Anderson, he said, I can't give you any more. It'll stop your breathing. So I said to Carmona, take your carbine and shoot me. I can't stand this pain. So that was about 11 o'clock in the morning, as they later on they were able to kind of tell me. That went on all the rest of that day. They wanted to get a stretcher party up, but the Japanese had moved in on the trail behind, and they couldn't bring anybody here. No ammunition or anything. They couldn't get anything up to us. They were still in radio communication with the rear, but they couldn't make physical contact because the Japanese had intervened. And they decided that maybe after dark they could circumvent the Japanese. So sometime after dark, they got a stretcher party up there to get me in. And they had took six guys on the stretcher to get me down off of there. So I didn't get down to the 1st Medical Squadron Station till somewhere around midnight. And I remember one instance on the stretcher on the way down. I was in and out all the time. But one instance, a problem that I got kind of aroused. They couldn't figure out how to get me down off this level, but somehow they did. They laid us out in the yard before they finally got me into a surgeon, and all I can remember, somebody woke me up enough to say that I was getting my first blood transfusion. They showed me the name on the bottle there, and they read it off to me. Gaeus, G-A-Y-E-O-U-S. Gately, G-A-T-E-L-E-Y. Anyway, that was the first blood transfusion that I got.
And what all did they have to do surgically for you?
They didn't really do much except took out quite a few pieces. They reconstructed, later on they told me, what apparently had happened. I had a pair of binoculars on, and the bullet hit the binoculars first and disintegrated partially. So in the stuff that they took out of me was the pieces of binocular castings, piece of glass, leather from my wallet that was in my chest pocket here, piece of paper from stuff that was in the wallet, bullet fragments, and some of the bullet fragments they wrapped up. Here's the dog tags. That's all I got back with.
You were wearing these?
That's what I had on at the time.
You had this dog tag on at the time, and you've saved it with the leather strap.
And it's still blood-soaked, and that shoestring is still soaked with my blood.
Wow.
And they were finding all that stuff in me, so apparently the bullet fragment, there's one large piece that's about as big as my thumbnail still down underneath there, and with that adhesive tape that's wrapped around them there that you see, they had a piece of the bullet fragments that they had found in the outer layers of skin there. All those pieces of stuff that you see shattered through there,
yeah,
that's a good part of that is binocular.
Yeah.
And if it hadn't, the binocular hadn't been on there, it's very likely the bullet would have gone through much cleaner.
And not spread out so much debris in there.
Yeah.
And they had to take out a couple of your ribs?
Yeah, that happened a year and some months after. These two ribs that they took out wouldn't heal. They developed osteomyelitis, and they were getting worse and worse.
But basically, the whole right side of your chest
is
crushed, destroyed, bruised.
Right.
Your lung was damaged.
Right. The first operation, they didn't think there was anything in the lung. It was collapsed. And when the lung collapses, apparently a hard coating forms on there, and they have to strip all that. They called it a decortication operation. They stripped that off before the lung can re-expand. Apparently they did that, but apparently there was still stuff in there because in January of 1946, I started coughing up blood. They couldn't figure out what that was, but they took a lot of pictures and stuff in there. Again, the Veteran Administration was completely overwhelmed. They couldn't find a bed to put me in. They wanted to send me up to some hospital up way up in Oregon, and I didn't want to go up there because I didn't know anybody. I had the job down there that I thought I would, because I went back to work on January the 1st.
Well, wait a second, though. You went back to work, but I know that one of the other effects of that injury, at least in the immediate aftermath, was you really didn't have the use of your right arm, right?
Yeah, right.
What, what kind of state were you in for the next few weeks after you got hit?
Initial medical help.
Yeah.
I was transferred to the 41st Field Hospital in Quezon City. That was a place to get your feet back underneath of you and get a little weight going back and so forth. And I was there for several weeks. They moved us down on the docks in Manila and put us on a hospital ship for a general hospital down in New Guinea, back at Hollandia. I was on this hospital ship on April the 10th, my birthday, on the 12th of April, and the day that President Roosevelt died, that came in over the radio, that President Roosevelt, and then I wound up down in this 54th General Hospital in Hollandia for quite a while. That's where my arm wasn't working.
And when you say it wasn't working, you had no control of it all or no strength?
It was cold. I couldn't lift it. I could feel some. I could move my fingers and so on, but I couldn't do anything with them.
Because there was muscle damage from the shot you received.
And they also said there was probably some nerve damage,
sure,
which disappeared. That problem disappeared later on.
I'm sure a lot of people are listening to this and they're thinking, well, how long did it take them to recover? And that's probably not a simple question, because in some ways you probably never recovered.
Yeah, that's right. I'm short 50% of my normal air.
How has that affected your everyday life?
It was interesting as at work, you know. These eager beaver bosses, you know, when they make a factory tour, they go out at full stride, you know. If I was in one of these parties, you know, by the time we'd get about halfway through a department, I would go, everybody would go, what's the matter with this guy? One other interesting aspect to this mental, I was walking down the aisle one day by the acetylene welding department, and you know when you hang acetylene torch up once in a while, it goes pop, 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 pop. I was walking by, this guy hung up his torch there, and it went pop, 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 and I found myself under this workbench over here.
You thought you were back in the jungle of the Philippines dodging bullets, huh?
Yeah, just like that.
And the other thing I've got to say, I don't want to be melodramatic, but we talked about your four kids and 13 grandkids and 30 great-grandkids. And after hearing your story, it sure seems like it's a miracle that any of them were ever born, because most people wouldn't have survived what you went through, and it sounds like it took a lot of help from a lot of other people to save your life.
That's absolutely true. I've had help all of my life, and that's another thing I marvel at. My grandmother picked me up after my mother died. My friends in San Francisco picked me up after I lost my place on the ranch. On and on and on and on.
And those guys had to drag you out of the spot where you got hit.
Yeah.
And they're risking their own lives in doing so.
Absolutely. All the way. And all the other people down the line that have ever had anything to do with. And you, now here, you're helping me spread the word, which is something I believe in. We need a lot of improvement in our patriotism in this country. We are in a wonderful country that we live in, and you only have to see the results of occupation like occurred in the Philippines that other countries do to you, and what it might have been like had they been successful in doing that to us, including the Japanese and the Germans.
For those of us who weren't alive during World War II, who didn't see any of this, who didn't understand what could have been and what almost was, what do you think we need to know about you and all the guys like you who risked their lives for our country?
I would like to hope that we could all be aware of what it took, of what it was and what they did, and order their lives accordingly, and also somehow gather the feeling that they too could make a contribution like that if they were called on to do that.
You made it very clear how close you came to not coming home, to adding to that number of over 400,000 Americans who died in World War II. How often over the years have you thought about some of those guys you knew who didn't come home?
Almost every day. For example, this Carmona that I mentioned, he lies in the Roswell Cemetery. He was given a Silver Star for his action the next day after I was wounded in killing the Japanese that stopped me. The other one that I turned up, I mentioned earlier that I stepped aside to let my BAR man shoot this first Japanese. He received a Distinguished Service Cross for his actions on March the 9th, along with Carmona, in subduing the Japanese strong point.
And am I understanding that they were both killed that day?
They were both killed. They were both awarded their awards, the Silver Star and Distinguished Service Cross, posthumously.
And with Carmona, people remember, you're saying he was killed the day after you were hit. But what you shared with us is that he was one of those who helped save your life by cradling you and holding you upright so you didn't drown in your own blood.
Absolutely. And a day later, he was dead. I forever have a debt to him. I think about some of this stuff every day.
That was Patch Curtis of the 1st Cavalry Division. You can link to his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. As he was recovering from the injuries he suffered on Luzon, the next vet you'll hear from was on his way to that island. And he had already gone through being declared an enemy by the very country where he was born. Hear that explanation when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Music. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special 4th of July weekend edition of the program. If you're a regular listener, you've heard Americans from just about every possible background, no matter what part of our country they came from, how much money they had or didn't have, what their political views were, or what their ethnic background was. We've heard veteran after veteran echo that idea that it took a truly united United States of America to defeat, with the help of its allies, the tyrannical forces that threatened the very concept of freedom in World War II. For 33,000 American veterans of Japanese ancestry, it meant believing the ideals of the American experiment were worth fighting for, even when they had been stripped away from them on account of their heritage. Sherman Kishi was on his way to the Philippines at this time 75 years ago, but to understand his reality in 1945, we have to go back to December 7th, 1941, in his native Livingston, California.
I was playing tennis in high school, and I was on the high school team. And so we practiced a lot of tennis. And this was early Sunday morning. There were four of us that went to play at the high school tennis courts to try to improve our game. And we were playing at the high school tennis courts. And as we were playing there, a car stopped by the side of the road. There were two or three men in the car, I don't remember. But they opened their windows and started to curse at us and call us all kinds of names. And it just really made us feel bad. And so, of course, we quit very shortly and went home. And came home, and when we came home, we heard on the radio that Pearl Harbor had happened. And that was a change for all the United States and all the world, really, basically, but I think maybe a little bit more for some of us of Japanese ancestry in the United States. We went on to school after 9066 until about May. And then in May of that year, 1942, the orders came out, and there were posters on the telephone poles and fence posts that told us that we had to go to an assembly center. At that stage, we quit school and got prepared to have to leave. So that's what happened during that period of time.
And you tell that very matter-of-factly, but I'm sure at the time that was quite a shock to you and had to be pretty emotional to be a 17-year-old kid and being told the place you've lived your whole life, you're not welcome anymore.
Yeah, it was very much so. It was particularly difficult, I think, for our parents. You have to remember that our parents were quite young yet. Many of the parents were in their 40s, late 40s, and in their 50s. And so they were in the prime of their life, and they had farmed here all their lives, and all of a sudden, everybody had to leave. So I know that once this had happened, they became so fearful of anything that was Japanese that I remember anything that we had in the house that looked a little bit Japanesey, as much as we could, we destroyed, buried, or burned. And that happened to all the families in the area. So that's the kind of thing that happened during that period of time. Yeah. And, you know, interestingly, they gave us this notice about 3 weeks before we had to go. The day that we went on was my 17th birthday. So I remember it very vividly. This was May the 13th of 1942. And that's the day we went into the Assembly Center in Merced.
Which is where the Merced County Fairgrounds are now?
Yes, it's where the fairground is now. We have put up a monument there in memory of that with all the names of the people that are on a wall. So that's where we got sent in. And I remember mostly being put onto buses at our church. And then we went on the bus to Merced. And we went to the, it used to be the armory there, right on 17th Street, and it's still there. And they took us there, and the first time we got there, we got out of the bus right in front, and there was a gentleman who was a dentist from San Francisco that spoke to us and told us that we had to behave and do what they asked us to do, and basically that's what we did and went into the Assembly Center, which was mostly prepared at that time.
How scared and unsettled were you? Because, I mean, that seems like a pretty imposing and uncertain future you were facing.
You know, when you're young like that, you don't think of that as much. But I'm sure that the parents were very upset. For some of us who were at that age, were young teenagers yet, it was sort of fun because we never met so many Japanese people in our lives. And very shortly after going into the camp, we had some very well-educated people who had gone to college, unable to get jobs because jobs weren't available to people of Japanese descent. And so they were well-educated, and they immediately started things within the camp. And one of the things that started was baseball. and baseball became a very popular pastime in Merced Assembly Center as it was in the later relocation camps. So there were things like talent shows. I remember very vividly one talent show that we went to that had a young lady from Walnut Grove who had a beautiful contralto voice. And one of the most popular songs that was sung at the time was God Bless America. Can you imagine? Yeah, that's what happened during those days, yeah.
And the irony, huh? Yes, God bless America when you're basically being held prisoner by America.
That's exactly right. Yeah. But we didn't think of it that way, I guess. All of this area was sent to Amache, Colorado. Camp Amache, it was called. It's right at Grenada, Colorado, which is in the southeastern corner of Colorado.
And what was life like there?
Like every other camp, it was in the most desolate place that they could find. Really, I think it was the most desolate place that they could find in Colorado. And they had trouble finding places for these camps. We know that it was cold in the winter. It was dusty because almost all the camps were made by dozing off the sagebrush wherever it may be. That was included Topaz, included Heart Mountain. All the camps were the same, and all the Arizona camps were all the same. One of the most violent and worst thing that we remember is the dust storms that we used to have because they were so bad. But we all lived through that, eventually made the relocation camps a livable place. They planted trees and planted gardens, and things changed in those camps.
And how did it come about that you decided to go fight for the country that was holding your family hostage?
In 1942, after 9066, there was still a draft going on, of course, and they changed the status of all people of Japanese ancestry from a 1A status to a 4C status, which was an enemy alien status. So we were no longer eligible for the draft. So I, in 1942 and 43, I finished my high school, and during that period of time, they came in to recruit for the 442nd. I couldn't get into the service at that stage, but just before I graduated, they also came in to recruit for MIS. And I studied a little bit of Japanese in the camp. I had a very, very smattering of Japanese in the community before the war, but very little. And so I studied a little bit in camp and learned a little bit of the alphabet, basically. And when they came in, they accepted me. I had talked to my father about this, and I told him that I wanted to go, and he said, "This is your country. You go right ahead and do what you think is best." So my father approved my going as well.
And did your brother go in before or after you?
No, my brother is 4 years older than I am, but he had been going to University of California before the war. And my father became sick in 1941, and so he had to come back and help run the farm. And, of course, the war happened, and so we all went to the camps. And as soon as he was able, he went to go back to college to try to finish his college. And he went back to Maryland, University of Maryland, and was enrolled there and was going to school there. And the draft began in 1944. And I had volunteered into the service and got into the service in November of 1943. So I was in before he got in. He got drafted shortly after the draft began. So he came in 1944 into the service.
Yeah, once they took so many casualties overseas, they realized they could draft the people they had declared as enemy aliens after all, huh?
Well, I guess that's what happened. By then, you know, the 100th Battalion came out of Fresno, had done a tremendous job in Italy, and they needed lots of replacements. When they came in to recruit for the 442, which the 100th became part of, there were many of them that joined at that time. Most of the people that joined when they first came in to recruit were volunteers, but later they were drafted and put into the service, and most of them went into the 442.
And that 442nd Regimental Combat Team, of course, is legendary for its courage, its bravery, the amount of decorations per capita blows everything else away in World War II. And you mentioned you were too young to join the 442 when they came through. Had you been old enough, do you think you would have?
I probably would have, yes, because I had many friends that did. So, yeah, I probably would have joined if I was old enough.
You had many friends that joined. How many of those friends came home?
In our small community, we lost 3 in Italy and France. And so that's a pretty good percentage of young men that we lost in Europe with the 442.
Have you ever thought about that, that
had you been able to join the 442nd and went over there, whether or not you would have survived?
Oh, yeah. I've thought about that many times. But I had a brother-in-law married to my youngest sister. That's before he's married. He was in the service and was sent over there. But he survived through all the battles, and he was a company runner. And a company runner's job was the communication between the front lines and the company. So he was in a very dangerous position, but he survived without a scratch through all that. And so you never know, you know, when that happens, it just happens. So you can't tell what's going to happen.
No, you can't. And, of course, you didn't serve in the 442nd, but I imagine you still take some pride in what those people who were facing similar circumstances as you were did accomplish. When you hear someone talk about today that phrase, go for broke, does it mean something to you? And if so, what?
That phrase means a lot. That means you do everything that you possibly can to do whatever you're doing. The young men that were my friends who were in MIS, there were a number of them killed as well in the Pacific. And they did a tremendous job over there. I had a good friend that ended up in Burma as part of the Mero Marauders. And he went through that campaign, and he survived through it. There was a lot of things that happened in the Pacific as well as in the 442 in Europe.
Well, and I want to hear about what you did. And some folks might not know what MIS stands for. That's Military Intelligence Service?
That's correct. Yeah, Military Intelligence Service is what we were in. You know, when I got out of school, I had to go to basic training after that, after I learned my Japanese. And so by the time I was eligible to go overseas, it was starting to get a little late in the war. And I was ready in 1945, finally. After basic training and after my training, I went through a 9-month program of learning Japanese.
Was that hard for you?
Oh, was that ever hard? Can you imagine getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning and getting ready for reveille and all that, and then going to class at 8 o'clock, staying in class until 4 o'clock, and then having your military things after that? And then we went back to classes at 7 o'clock at night, and we stayed there until at least 9. And so we had all that time to learn the Japanese language, and it was not easy, and we didn't have enough time. So we used to put flashlights under the blanket. We used to go to the latrine where there's light, and we used to study so we could learn enough to get by. Yeah, it was the toughest schooling that I ever went through.
I know you lived it, and it's easy to maybe in retrospect not read too much into it. But I think a lot of people that didn't go through what you went through think, where do you find the motivation to put in that kind of effort, again, for a government, for a country that is holding your family prisoner, as, you know, that you've had to move away from the land that you've had your entire life, and here they are in this internment camp? How did you get past that mentally and emotionally, and how would you describe the mindset you did have?
You know, I didn't think about that very much, frankly. This was our country. This is the only country that we knew. And this is the only country we're loyal to. All we thought about was doing what we needed to do for our own country. We knew that Japan, our folks came from Japan, but that really didn't cut any ice with us because we never knew any of those people over there. And so they became our enemies, basically.
And that attitude you described, did you feel like that was pretty common among the other men that you were training with?
Yes, I think so. I think so. Although you have to realize that when we went to the MIS, there were many young men who were called kibes. And kibe means a young person of the ancestry who were sent back as citizens from the United States to Japan to be educated. And so there were many of those people that were in MIS. And some of them had some completely different feelings about it. There were some of the kibes who were very hopeful that Japan would win. But basically, they were very loyal to the United States. And most of the translating and interpreting that was done in the Pacific was basically done by the kibes. The niseis were not very strong in Japanese, and so they did most of the English writing that had to be done on the reports and things. And so you have to give a lot of credit to those young men who learned the language in Japan and came back and fought for the United States.
So after 9 months of that schooling, staying up with your flashlight to study Japanese, what happened next?
One of the interesting things about that period is that they had some classes for the Caucasian people to learn Japanese. They had a class at the University of Denver. They also had a class at University of Michigan. And this was to learn Japanese to become translators and interpreters. And they went to the university, learned the language for 2 years. When they got done, they came out with bars on their shoulders. They became lieutenants. When we came out of our school after 9 months, and some of them were in 6 months class, if we were lucky, we came out with 2 stripes on our arm as corporals. So things were a little different. Yeah. That's sort of interesting that such a thing as that happened. After that happened, we waited for a while, and in July of 1945, I got onto a ship out of San Francisco, and I remember the Golden Gate Bridge going away, wove our way back and forth across the Pacific. It took us a whole month to get to the Philippines. I was, along with many other the young men, were put into what they call ATIS, which is Allied Translating and Interpreting Section. This is of MIS. There's a racetrack right out of Manila, and that's where we were stationed, and we did some translating and things while we're there. I was there for about a month, and of course the war ended in August. By the middle of August, it was all done. Japan had surrendered, and so shortly thereafter, they sent us into Japan as part of the occupation forces.
A lot of people don't even realize how much of a challenge it was for a lot of Japanese American families to get their land back, if that was even an option. In your case, here you are on the property where you were born. How did that work out? How was it that your family came to recover this land after the war was over?
My family was not part of the cooperatives. So we asked our high school ag teacher, who we knew was a very nice gentleman, to run our farm for us. And his name was Eldon Callister. He ran our farm for us during that period of time. And the person that was what we call the chicken doctor, because we had chickens across the street there, egg-laying chickens. And he took over our house and continued that business there. And I think they all did quite well farming for us during that period of time because they left some money in the bank for us when we came back. So we had some very fortunate friends to have. And I didn't realize that Eldon Callister was a Latter-day Saint at the time, but he was. And he was a very honest man and did a great job for us. So we were very fortunate.
And I guess at that time, maybe you didn't realize how fortunate you were. But in the years since, as you've met other Japanese American veterans, has it struck you that your situation and how that worked out for you was a lot better than a lot of Japanese American families experienced?
There's no question about that. Most of the people that lived in the cities lost their businesses, lost everything that they had, and they didn't have too much to begin with. So when they came back, they had to start all over again, and it was very difficult for them.
When you think about your children and your grandchildren, what do you hope that they understand about what Japanese Americans went through in America during World War II, what you and your family went through? What do you hope they know years and years from now?
Well, that's a pretty tough question. I think that the thing that they will probably learn is that this country, which is unique in the world, I think, is able to do things to right what was done that was wrong at the particular time. And this country did do that for us. They righted the wrong when they had the redress action back in 1988. There was a lot of activity that went into that. It took 10 years before this happened. There were many congressional hearings and things that went on. But at that time, they gave an apology to us for letting that happen. And, of course, they gave us some redress as well. They gave us each $20,000 as a result of the relocation that they did. And one of the things that I prize the most is the apology that came from President Bush, because he was the president at the time that they sent the letters out. So I hope that the children will look at that and realize what a great country we have.
The voice of Sherman Kishi. You can link to his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. And we're not done yet. When this Independence Day edition of the program continues, somebody who understood what the double V meant in World War II, one of the Mumford Point Marines. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Loeffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, picking up some 4th of July perspective today through the stories of three World War II veterans and where they found themselves 75 years ago. Robert Hammond was a 19-year-old Navy corpsman serving in the Pacific with the Munford Point Marines, a segregated unit formed after the Marine Corps finally opened up to African Americans in 1942. Hammond, who went on to a long career in the field of public health, was born to a white mother and a black father in Philadelphia. He had never encountered the kind of racial discrimination he witnessed when training with the Munford Point Marines in North Carolina.
What had happened was a Marine from New York had gotten off the bus and went into the station there and asked. They had brought in vending machines for cigarettes, and he walked into the white side, not paying attention. They had signs up, colored white. Then he went in the white side and threw a dollar bill at the lady and asked, "Say, sweetheart, can we change for a dollar?" And she threw four quarters at him, and then she looked at him and then screamed. And then the police came and arrested him and took the guy and put him in jail. Now, word got back to Munford Point that there was a Marine in jail down there. So it got over to Bobby Troop, Sergeant Fisher, who was white, another sergeant, very liberal people. They didn't go for that discrimination because they weren't from the South. And they said, "We're going to go get that Marine." 1,000 black Marines got in trucks with 50-caliber machine guns on it. And we went into town, in that little old town. The railroad track went right down the middle, this side and that, black people this side, white people this side. City Hall was on this side. And the police station was on that side. And we went down there. And when we got down there, they were beating this Marine up. We arrested the whole police force.
Wow.
It was about eight policemen in there, the chief of police and everybody else, and took them back to Munford Point and put them in the brig. Then all hell broke out from that. The commandant of the Marine Corps, he came over. What are you men going into town arresting police officers for? So we told him what he did. He said, "We're not going to leave a Marine behind. What are you talking about? You're the commandant of the whole Marine Corps. Would you leave him behind?" We had Tom McFadder at the time, Sergeant Thomas McFadder. He was the one that said, "Can't leave him there." Tom wrote a book called Caught in the Middle. And he became a Navy chaplain later on. But anyway, we took the Marine back, locked those officers up. The colonel just left us alone. They said, "You guys go ahead and do what you're going to do." Just left us alone. And we kept those policemen in there for 5 days in the brig and on bread and water and turned them loose. And we told them, "Don't you ever mess with a Marine again." That's what McFadder told them. "Don't mess with any of these Munford Point Marines." Because people were spitting on them and just harassing them and treating them mean. "Boy, where'd you get that uniform? You don't belong in it," and spit on them. They cut all that stuff, was cut out. But that was, to me, it was outrageous behavior. And I had never seen this. Here I'm going to go fight Germans and Japanese, and here they're treating us worse than them because they had some German prisoners of war there. They treated them better than us. So that kind of got us. Later on at Munford Point, another thing happened that's not written about, and that was the Royal Dutch Marines came to Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, 5,000 of them. And these Marines had come from, I think they were over in North Africa someplace. When Hitler invaded their land, they went over there. Then they went to the Caribbean. And then they went through training. And they were there at Camp Lejeune to learn amphibious training, because they're going to reinvade where Hitler was and where the Japanese was in the Pacific. And what they said was, the commandant, the Marine Corps, came and told the commandant of those Royal Dutch Marines, because they had 500 black Royal Dutch Marines. And he did not want those black Marines in Camp Lejeune. Told that commander, send those Marines over to Mumford Point. We segregate them here. That did not fly. That commander says, you don't leave a Marine behind. We're not going to leave any of ours. Those are our Marines. Where they go, we go. Now, if they're going to Mumford Point, we went. So 5,000 Royal Dutch Marines went over to Mumford Point, and we had a ball with those guys. I mean, especially, you know, after it going down to the beer hall and all of that, with the music and things, we had a ball with those guys. They stayed there for 3 or 4 weeks, and then they left. But that was an experience to see. And what it did to me, I said, my God, I'd write letters home to my mother and tell her about it. And she'd say, Robert, I'm going to tell you something. If people are going to be prejudiced against you, make them pay for it. Don't you ever forget them. Make them spend some money. That's the only thing they know is money. So that stuck with me throughout my lifetime. Make them pay. If they're going to discriminate against you, make them pay. But anyway, a lot was going on there with the Medical Corps. The Marines got better. They got better treatment. They bowed down now to a corpsman. We were the first ones in line at the Chow Hall. They waited on us. When we went out on liberty, they gathered around us and just took care of us. We didn't have to spend one penny for nothing if we went out with those Mumford Pointers. So when we got overseas, they still rallied around the corpsman. And the corpsman had to look, there's about four platoons. Platoon had 40 men. And that's 160 men. We had to watch them, keep an eye on them. Something happened to them, you were there with them. And they knew that. The military part of what we did at Mumford Point was outstanding. The guys were expert marksmen with artillery. They were expert. Anti-aircraft guns. They had the 51st, 52nd anti-aircraft battalions. And one day they were shooting target practice. And they said, you guys are missing the target. And they said, no, we're not aiming at the target. We're aiming at the string. And then one shell went right and clipped the target. So that happened. In marching, if you ever watch the Marines march, you'll see a swagger that they got from the Mumford Point Marines, from Big Elmo. They put these men in ammo companies and supply companies, non-combat battalions. We all had weapons. If we had to use them, we used them. But we had all the food, all the medical supplies. We had all the ammunition. We had everything the Marines would want. And we brought those to those islands.
And you ended up on Guam, is that right?
I ended up there at Camp Wise at the medical dispensary on Guam. We had a small hospital there. Then over, we called it Barracuda Village, near the airfield up there in the Gana, where the Marines were. That was the 51st and 52nd anti-aircraft companies up there. Later on, we had two black doctors. One was a Lieutenant J.G., another one was a full lieutenant. Alvin Lawrence was lieutenant. He was from Chicago. C.J. Jones from New York, from Brooklyn, he was Lieutenant J.G. They had some stories. I wish they were alive, because they told me what they were up against as officers. A lot of the white sailors and Marines wouldn't salute them. And Dr. Jones went and put his hat on a post and told this Marine, if you can't salute me, you salute that hat. But he went through a lot. But if somebody, and he was a surgeon, and he treated a lot of those guys. And one of the things that they did, they carried segregation too far. They segregated blood. 1X for white, 2X for black, 3X for Mexican, 4X for Native American on the bottles. Wow. When blood is only A, A, B, and O, you know. And one time in surgery, I went and got, they were operating on this white guy. They needed blood, and they told me to go down and bring back some A blood. I brought back a bottle of A blood. I didn't know nothing about these X's, and it had 2 X's on it. And I handed it to the nurse. She dropped it on the floor, broke it. And the doctor there operated, what did you drop that for? And she said, we can't give him, use the N-word, blood. Wow. And that doctor said, listen, blood is blood. I wanted A blood, give it to him. I don't care what the X's are. It doesn't mean a damn thing.
Right.
So in the meantime, you had a hematologist named Dr. Charles Drew, who invented blood plasma. The United States wouldn't use its plasma, so he took it to England. And when Hitler was bombing England, 1945, tearing it up, there was a shortage of blood. The Americans wanted to know, you have a shortage of blood over here? He said, no, we use Dr. Drew's blood plasma. And they said, oh, we can't use that. It's crystal. We can't segregate it. And they laughed at the American doctors for that. See? And then they started using it. And right then and there, they start using this plasma. They took the X's off those bottles. And then Roosevelt died after that. When Roosevelt died and Harry Truman got in there, all sorts of things were happening in the armed forces, black troops, the army. You had Camp Van Dorn. You had Fort Bliss, riots. You had Port Chicago, and there was one up, Shoemaker, there was one up there, Tuskegee Airmen. There's one in Louisiana. All these broke out, and it started affecting the war effort. And Harry Truman says, we're not going to have none of that. We're going to integrate the whole thing. And I don't care if those Southern colonels and generals object to it. They could get the hell out. That's what they could do. So the whole thing got integrated in 48.
Right.
And all that stuff stopped. My learning from being in the Marine Corps, a lot of those guys distinguished themselves. A few of them got, under Clinton, Congressional Medal of Honor. Some of them were dead. I think 3 of them were living. I think they gave Miss Daly, the first black nurse, they gave her one. I think they gave her one. I didn't get anything.
But one thing you did get recently with a lot of your fellow Munford Point veterans was the Congressional Gold Medal. To have that happen so long after the fact, more than 65 years after World War II, what did that mean to you? Was it better late than never?
At my age now, and with the experiences that I had in the Navy and Marine Corps, I knew the Golden 13. Matter of fact, George C. Cooper, one of them, was my boss in Dayton, Ohio, when I was the director of health there. And my whole career was centered around my corpsman activities in the Marine Corps and Navy, because I didn't want to do corrective medicine. I wanted to do preventative medicine. So I got into the environmental health aspect of it and followed that, public health. And that was my career. I was able to do a lot of things, especially here. I became the chief of environmental health for a county in Los Angeles, director of health in Dayton, Ohio, assistant director for Montgomery County in back east there, and World Health. I did a little bit of work with them. I'm a member of the Royal Society of Health. So my background was very based upon what I had learned in the Marine Corps and the kinds of things that I did. I used to be the suture man. I could sew a guy up. I mean, really sew him up. And some of these Mumford Pointers, even today, when they see me, they call me the devil doc. They said, see that hand, you sewed it up. And it was perfect. Dr. Jones used to say, who did this? I said, I did. He says, you need to be a surgeon. I said, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to keep people from getting sick. They're not going to have any wars when I come out of here. So I was very grateful to have that kind of experience. I mean, racism, Jim Crowism, I broke down a lot of those barriers. And I've got 1,000 stories I could tell in regards to mistreatment, but I had some good treatment while I was in there.
So you can see the value of your experience and what it led to later on in your life, but I imagine it was still really satisfying to be there with all these other veterans who were mistreated but still served their country, that put their lives on the line, and to have the Congress of the United States hand you these big heavy medals and say, you know what, you're special. What was that like for you?
Well, I felt very proud of that because it made me feel that I'm 100% American, and I remember when we went to the memorializing of the Battle of Iwo Jima at Arlington Cemetery. President Clinton was there, and we were there, and he mentioned, he said, those men over there are members of the Double V. And we all laughed and did that to him. He knew what it was. He said they had 2 wars to fight, one at abroad and one at home, and they won both of them. Then that made me feel proud, and to get that Congressional Gold Medal made me even feel prouder because it brought back some pleasant memories, like at the Brooklyn Naval Hospital. When I was there, we were all lined up outside for the president. Harry Truman came to visit the hospital. And we were at Captain's Muster there. And he came down, came right over to me. He said, boy, he said, son, you're looking good. And he straightened my tie. He shook hands with me and he kept on going with his big hat. President of the United States. So all of these things turn to, you know, being a citizen of being born in this country. And I say, now, sometimes I say, now, who do I really belong to? You know, I'm not going to say I belong to this group. I belong to that group. I belong to all of them. So that makes me 100% American with no hyphens.
You know, that comment has always stuck with me. 100% American with no hyphens. America wasn't perfect in World War II. We know it isn't perfect now. But the men that you heard from today and millions of American men and women before and since have believed enough in the principles that have been reverberating since July 4th, 1776, that they've risked their lives in an effort to see that promise of unalienable rights for all people move closer to reality. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you that on Independence Day and every day, freedom is not free.